We'll start. So we're just in the middle of a small series, which I've called Reflections. In other words, sharing with you the three messages that I took from the banquet of the Kinnus, overseas, the conference. So today, last week we did one, which was about the resilience, determination, mission coming from that child who lost his legs, and then the rabbi, the shliach, that the same thing happened to him, and the way they presented it and the way they talked about it was quite amazing. So today, I want to share and unpack a little bit another message. I'll just tell you the story, what it is, the way it was presented, and then sort of unpack it a bit. So this was a segment to do with a young rabbi, young shaliach, who's the shaliach, he's the Chabad emissary in Jamaica. Like, I don't even know what Jamaica is. that's actually because I failed geography in school. But
it's in Caribbean.
Caribbean, right? Yeah. So it's like an island almost, right? Yeah, that's it. So anyway, this is a shliach in Jamaica. He went there a couple of years ago. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. But his mother's my second cousin. So actually, I do know the family a bit. And he does wonderful work in Jamaica. There's a small community of locals, very small. Local Jewish, very beautifully how they spoke it. They were lonely and waiting for someone to come give them connection. But also he deals with a lot of tourists, right? There's a lot of tourists that go there. And then, of course, there was the tremendous challenge of the hurricane a few months ago, which he was very affected. Thank God his family was all safe. It was actually very dangerous for a day or two. So now he puts on tefillin with people, gives shiurim, hosts Shabbos meals, he gives Torah classes, and he's done some wonderful things there. So the story that was presented in this video, and that he spoke very passionately afterwards about the mission, he's a third generation shaliach. So his grandfather on his father's side, I didn't know him personally, but I knew who he was. I saw him in 770 when nobody come visit. His name was Rabbi Label Ruskin. In fact, those of you who might know in Sydney, Dvorah Markowitz. Dvorah Markowitz and sister is his husband. He's no longer alive. He passed away, unfortunately, a little bit young from cancer. But he was a shliach. His grandfather was a shliach to Morocco. One of the early, early Chabad emissaries of the Rebbe in the 50s, like 50s, 60s. 50s, I think. Where he traveled all the way to Morocco, which in that time was like a ridiculous thing to do. And when he went to Morocco, it was an amazing community. There was a flourishing Sephardi community there. You know, there was a chief rabbi just, not recently, but the two Sephardi chief rabbis ago, was Rabbi Amar. I don't know if that name means anything, but he was a Sephardi chief rabbi in Israel. And he was born in Morocco, and he learnt, he wouldn't even come here, he would tell a story, he learnt with one of the early shluchim, another person, Rabbi Lipsky, his name was, in Chabad. There was a big Chabad school there because it was an amazing, big, big community. But this Rabbi Ruskin, I knew who he was, and I saw him talk sometimes, and he was a very dedicated follower of the Rebbe. He was a very, very, had shlichus in his veins, tremendous commitment and dedication. I say that because the story with him was that when the Moroccan Jewish community started to dwindle, today it's a very small community, it's still there, but it's a very small community. He was asked, like, okay, so when are you leaving? He says, well, I'm not leaving because I was sent here to inspire Jewish people. As long as there's one Jew to inspire, I'm still here, right? The postscript to that is he passed away subsequently, and his wife is still there. She refuses to move because that's her mission, and she's there. Okay. So he tells a story because he spoke, and he says a story. He gave his grandfather as an example, because he says his grandfather, by his bar mitzvah, a young kid at 13, this Rabbi Ruskin, who spoke at the kinnus, this young person, so he said that when he was bar mitzvah, his grandfather was there, and his grandfather told him that at your bar mitzvah, you need to take upon yourself, this is going to be your life's mission. You can do the same thing. You're going to go and spread Yiddishkeit and teach other people. It's like amazing. Then his father, who I know also, his father was in yeshiva, he was a bit older than me, a little bit yeshiva with me, he married my second cousin. He went to Canada on shlichus, And then this guy, as he grew up, he was determined to go on Shlichut as well, and he ended up in Jamaica. He says, when he came then, there was no resources. Jews weren't coming to him. He said, they used to go to outside the hotels and wait for people and sort of, you know, find people, ask them. And people asked him, like, how did you come here? Like, how did you come to a place where there's no infrastructure? So he came to a place, there's no shul, no kosher food, no mikveh, nothing, absolutely nothing, right? So he says, and I think I might have mentioned this last week quickly, but I'll just mention it again. He said that what keeps him going, not only what kept him going, but what keeps him going, is a line that the Lubavitch Rebbe told Rabbi Sacks. When Rabbi Sacks was a young student in Cambridge, before he's even dreaming of going to the rabbinate, he's told the story many times, Rabbi Sacks. He's even told it once at the kinnus. In fact, he said, this shaliach said, when he was a young kid, he remembers Rabbi Sacks talking about it at the kinnus, and it stuck with him, this concept. So, I don't know if you know, so Rabbi Sacks was a young student, a philosophy student, and he decided he's traveling to America. He wants to meet the great Jewish leaders and interview them, ask them questions, philosophical questions, Jewish questions, and so on. So he tells the whole story, how he met with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he met with this one, with that one, and he wanted to meet with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he went to the office of the Lubavitcher Rebbe in Brooklyn. It was the kind of office, you have to understand, the whole empire ran from there, but it wasn't exactly run like with the greatest, you couldn't book an appointment online, if you know what I mean, right? So anyway, but I had a system. There was a system that used to work. And they walked to the office and he said, he says, impossible. It's not for another few months. He says, but I'm going back to England. Anyway, they took his name, his contacts, whatever. And he, in the meantime, went off to America and to talk to Jewish leaders. And he landed up in California. When he was in California, he tells a story. He got a call on a certain night in the middle, because the Rebbe used to have appointments throughout the night. Like whenever he had was what's called yichidut, private audiences. They started like at 9, 10 at night and they went through the night. Like when I had private audience with Rebbe in 1977, it must have been like 1 o'clock in the morning or something. But there were people who all hours of the night. So he got an appointment time, which didn't mean much, by the way, the appointment time, because it was up to the Rebbe. He would sometimes keep people longer, shorter. So you waited, whatever, you waited, you said to Hillim. Anyway, he said he didn't know how to get back from California because he didn't have any money, Rabbi Sacks. So he took a Greyhound bus. For a few days it took him to get back to New York, so he should have the appointment with the Rebbe. He came into the Rebbe. And he interviewed the Rebbe like he was planning to. He asked him a bunch of questions. Then, when he finished asking a bunch of questions, he said the Rebbe did something which later on, as someone much closer, or as Hasidim, we know it's very typical, but the Rebbe turned around the whole thing and says, okay, you've asked me questions, now I want to ask you questions. I want to interview you. So he didn't come to me there, like he got caught by surprise. And the Rebbe said to him, what are you doing for the Jews in Cambridge? Like, you're there, so what are you doing for them, right? So he wasn't doing much at all, actually. He was just studying philosophy. So he said to the Rebbe, in the situation that I find myself, and the Rebbe cut him off. He interrupted him. And he says, a Jew never finds himself in a situation. You put yourself in a situation. In other words, you make the situation, right? You're not in a situation. You create the situation. And that was for Rabbi Sacks very powerful, and he did start doing stuff with the students on Cambridge. Eventually, he got into the rabbinate, and he became the chief rabbi. But so this young guy, I don't know, he must be in his 20s, but he said he went to Jamaica. There was absolutely nothing to do, and he keeps hearing this line: "You're not in a situation; you make a situation." And today, there's a mikveh in Jamaica. There's kashrut. It was actually in the video. There's like a whole. It's called the kosher stop or something like a delicatessen. There's a shul. And he says the way he works is one Jew at a time. One Jew at a time. And he has his grandfather's line in his head that if as long as there's one Jew, you've got the mission is still there. And he's got the Rebbe's line that he told Rabbi Sacks that you're not in a situation, you make the situation. Okay, so that was basically and he spoke very beautifully about this whole thing and told the stories. And of course he told about the situation during the hurricane, how he became much more on the map in Jamaica because he took it on right away. As soon as it subsided, his mission became to help, number one, all the Jews on the island and even the non-Jews, and it was a very, very big deal. Okay, so this little clip that they showed and him speaking afterwards, it moved me on many levels, which I want to sort of unpack a little bit, break it down in a couple of different sections. So the first one is, The concept of having the sense of purpose, not only for Shiluchim, but for every Jew, every person actually, right? So what does that mean? So I want to just share with you a little bit on a deeper level, because we've endlessly talked about Viktor Frankl and his work, how a person has a desire to live with meaning and purpose and so on. And that's on a very basic level, that you have to have a sense of meaning. You always have to live for something higher than yourself, other than yourself, and so on and so forth. But if you take the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, right, when the Hasidic movement started, especially the Baal Shem Tov's teachings and how it was then developed by some of the other Rebbes throughout the generation, the concept of purpose actually becomes a lot deeper than that. Right? And I want to just share with you some insights from a book that was recently written, called On Purpose. And it's a collection of teachings of the Rebbes, of the Chabad Rebbes, about purpose. And I just want to share with you a couple of ideas so we understand the perspective of what purpose means. So he says, people, when they want to discover, it's a chapter on how you discover purpose, right? So he says, when seeking to discover our life's purpose, it's common to look for direction outside of ourselves. In other words, people look, so what can I do? What can I engage in? Ignoring my own circumstance, but I'm looking for something, so to speak, right? She says, it's interesting, of course, external circumstances and experience obviously play a very deep role in our life. That's true, right? But when you mix into the equation the concept of Hashgacha Pratit, not just Hashgacha Pratit in general, Hashgacha Pratit the way the Baal Shem Tov taught that. Now, it's very famous that the Baal Shem Tov took the concept of Hashgacha Pratit, which is divine providence, and brought it to a whole new level. So it's a very big topic. We've never actually explored it properly, but maybe one day we will. But it's actually not so clear in the early philosophers to what extent the concept of Hashgacha Pratit actually extends. Many of them sound like what the Baal Shem Tov is saying, but the Baal Shem Tov took it to a whole new level, and it became very widespreadly accepted by everyone. In every generation, things are revealed that weren't revealed in the previous generations. So there's no question, for example, that people are part of Hashgacha Pratit. Everything that happens to a person is by divine providence, even the smallest of details. There were some great Jewish philosophers who said that with other species, the fish of the sea, the animal kingdom, there's Hashgacha. Of course, Hashem doesn't abandon the world, and everything is kept alive by Hashem, and everything is supervised by God, but everything comes from God. But there's on some level where God doesn't have the same level of specific and detailed supervision on every detail, every specific thing that happens to the animal kingdom, much more in a general sense. Okay. Baal Shem Tov was very, very strong that it's not like that. And Baal Shem Tov was very, very strong. Hashgacha Pratit means that every single specific detail that happens in the world is Hashgacha Pratit. Famously, he took his students for a walk one day in the hot sun, and they passed a tree, and Baal Shem Tov was teaching this concept, and a tree shook and fell off, a leaf shook and fell off the tree. And Baal Shem Tov said to his disciples, you have to understand that even when a leaf shakes on a tree and falls off a tree, that's Hashgacha Pratit. And then he told one of his students to go up and lift the leaf off the ground. And lift the leaf off the ground, they found a worm that was very hot. And he said, this worm was there. For some reason, Hashem wanted to protect it from the heat of the sun, so that leaf fell down and protected the sun. Now, some people find it a very difficult concept to understand. That means my whole life is like all determined and run for me, right? So the answer is yes, it is, but it's not. Because what's not run, by, so to speak, by Hashgacha Pratit, is, as we've talked about many times, your response to what happens. So every detail, right? So we have huge choice. Hashgacha Pratit is not a contradiction to free choice. It's just a liberating understanding that everything that is run in the world, everything that happens, any circumstance that happens, is Hashgacha Pratit. It's now our choice how we respond to it, what we do with it, right? Baal Shem Tov took it a step further, and he said, not only, right, and this is a deep idea, he says, not only is Hashgacha Pratit on every single specific occurrence in the world, right, everything that happens by divine providence, but everything that happens by divine providence is part of the bigger puzzle. In other words, it relates to the overall purpose of creation. So, not always we see it, not always do we understand it, but we need to know that's the case so we can learn from it. I'll explain to you how in a minute, right? In other words, when that leaf fell down and covered the worm, it's not just that there was a specific incident, there was a worm and the worm was hot and the leaf fell down to cover the worm. Somehow the worm being there and the leaf falling in it also relates to other things that are going to happen as a result of it, which will all come together as part of the important screws and nuts and bolts of the overall plan of making this world a godly place. You understand the difference? In other words, it's a not just a specific thing, God made it happen, but it made it happen as part of the puzzle. Therefore, putting this all together, when we're talking about purpose, and this purpose could be purpose on a specific day or it could be our overall purpose, right? The previous Rebbe writes also that a person should, when they're looking for purpose, should take notice, right? Take notice of certain things that are happening in his or her life. Like, to whom are you born? Which place were you born? Where do you live? Why do you live there? All that kind of stuff, right? What talents do you have? Right? What capabilities do you have? They are all hashgacha pratit, and they're all part of the plan for the purpose. Right? Which means, if you have a specific talent, or specific skill, for example, right? It must be for a purpose. If something happens, you had a learning experience of some sort, it's for a purpose. I'll give you a little bit of an example, the Rebbe's view on this. So it's no secret that growing up in the Chabad system, the Rebbe actually discouraged young men particularly to go to university. Right? Do you know that? Because his view was that I never went to university. I got a degree later on in teaching and education. But his view was that when children finish school, it's a very, very important age to create the spiritual foundation for life, right? Profession and parnasa is something you can develop later, and you have to believe that God will provide, and so on and so forth. So that was the system. So in the typical Chabad system, we finished school, went right to yeshiva, and we learned in yeshiva. I learned yeshiva until I got married. And then another year, almost a year in kollel, which is like a post-marriage tertiary institution, right? And then I went into teaching, and then I figured, when I was in education, then I figured out that I should learn more about education, so when I was here, really, I did a course and turned it into a master's, and that's when I finished. Okay. But he didn't, right? So that was the thing. However, what was very fascinating is this. Part of this idea was also that he didn't, especially then, I guess, maybe now it's even worse, maybe it's even better, I don't know, but he also didn't, he was very, very afraid of the culture on the campuses, felt it was very spiritually detrimental, and that changed from decade to decade of why it was detrimental, but they were, you know, the 60s and that. So he actually discouraged it. He didn't, when people later on, when they were settled, they wanted to do a degree, they wanted to do a profession, he was very encouraging, but not for his students. However, here's the interesting part. When there were people who came from a secular background, and let's say halfway through university, they became religious, let's say, right? Which happened a lot. I have a cousin in Buffalo who brought many, many yeshivas to university. He's one of the first campus Chabad rabbis. Right now it's very common, but a very interesting guy. His name's Gerari, a very gung-ho guy. He was there with all the hippies in the 60s and that. He brought tons of people close to Judaism when the trend was moving away from Judaism. But he tapped into a very good energy. He tapped into the fact that they were looking for something. You know, the hippies, the all the craziness that was happening then, which is now happening again. It means they were looking for something. That's what the Rebbe always used to teach. And therefore, he tapped into that opportunity. So a lot of these people, and I've heard them talk, and I've heard them tell stories, and I know some of them in Sydney, that they went a little bit to yeshiva, they tasted it, they wanted to become religious, they think, and eventually they would come into an audience with the Rebbe, they had the opportunity to meet the Rebbe. And some of these people have become so excited about the Yiddishkeit and they were midway, let's say, a degree, they would want to give it up and go to yeshiva, right? And the Rebbe would never let them, almost consistently. Because he felt, although he had an approach of how he, in the first instance, how he'd approach boys growing up in the school system, the Torah system, but he felt if someone already landed there, everything at the end of the day, even if it was a choice, but everything at the end of the day retroactively is a shechach patit and needs to be used. Therefore, he would almost every time strongly encourage people to finish, not only finish, but to use it, There was a guy who wanted to become a rabbi. He ended up being a professor of something in university, and the rabbi did not let him become a rabbi. No, he told them they have to learn Torah, and they have to make time to learn Torah, and they, in the vacation, they should go to yeshiva for a few months, whatever the case was. But he didn't let them leave. On the contrary, he would encourage them and push them to finish what they were doing and then to use it out. So you have a few very famous Chabad Hasidim who were famous doctors, or famous professors, or famous whatever, people that, you know, and they had a lot of influence on other students and other people, because they never felt that was your calling. Because if that happens, Zashkachapratit falls into the concept of purpose. Right? Because otherwise, the years you spent there were for nothing. If you already spent it there, it must be used for a purpose. That was his thing, right? And that's also the Rebbe. And I'm not trying to encourage anyone one way or the other. But there was quite a consistent pattern that when someone lived somewhere, the Rebbe was not encouraging of people moving, just generally. Like he would, I mean, if there were circumstances that required you moving, you should move, of course, and there's lots of circumstances that. But generally speaking, his first response is like, are you spreading Yiddishkeit where you are? Well, then keep doing that. Like, right? Which is why also, like, the same thing with Rabbi Raskin's grandfather, like, he was in Morocco, that's his place, that's it, he's not moving. That's where he is, that's his purpose. Why? Because also part of Shkacha Pretit, there's a pasuk, there's a verse which says, Me Hashem mitzadei gever konanu, that Hashem plans the steps of the human being. Now, again, of course, lots of reasons why people move. But the point is, short-term and long-term, where a person comes, you don't come for the reason you think you came. You came because you're supposed to be there for the overall purpose. Your purpose is to inspire people, to teach people, to help people, whatever level of purpose a person can achieve. But that's the reason you're there. And by the way, it translates to a very day-to-day thing. You sometimes land up in a place you don't want to be. A plane might be redirected because they ran out of fuel or something or other, or there's a problem and you land in Brisbane instead of landing in Melbourne. And now you're stuck for 10 hours in Brisbane, right? The Jewish way, according to the Baal Shem Tov's teachings, is, first of all, it's an immense liberating thing because, like, why are you getting frustrated? A day in Brisbane, I wasn't, this is like a waste of time. No, it's not. You landed in Brisbane because you're supposed to land in Brisbane. Because you have a purpose in Brisbane. What your purpose is, I don't know. It's find something to do. Fine, right? Find something that you need to do there. It could be, who knows what. If you can't find, like, I told this story. I landed up 2 years ago. I don't always successfully apply this principle. I'm not very far from perfect. But 2 years ago, I always tell you, I only tell you the stories that worked, right? But 2 years ago, I landed up in Japan in the middle of the night. Me and Rabbi Chaitin, because we were in New York together. We got to California, hoping to take a plane to Sydney. And the plane couldn't take off. The air conditioning was brought, whole story. And then they had no other flights. They had to redirect us to Japan. It's the most craziest flight. We went all the way back to Japan. And then the next day from Japan to here, right? So we slept over in California. It was all a stupid thing. And I left in California. I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing in California? So I thought, you know, the first thing, I'm going to try to find a Jew in the airport. I look around, no one looks Jewish. Except for one person who looks slightly Jewish. He turns out to be an Arab. I thought he was like a Sephardi Jew or something. Not an Arab. Nice guy. Very nice guy, actually. But I'm thinking to myself, so what am I doing here? So then I decided, you know what? Obviously, I'm not going to get nervous. Another hour or two to the plane. I'm on this airport, not knowing why I landed up here. Maybe there's something that I have to learn some Torah in the airport. So I took out a Gemara. I took out a book that I had with me. And I tried to study. I was very tired on that, but I think I can't just sleep here. It must be a reason why I'm here. So I decided I'll study. I'll bring the holiness of Torah to the Japan airport. I'm sure people have done this before, but maybe there was a certain holiness that needed to come that night into the airport of Japan. I'm being serious with people, and it helped me a lot, right? Because I was very calm, which is a big progress from how I used to be. I'm still not calm, but I'm saying at that time. No, I mean, because I'm a very nervous flyer. It used to drive me crazy when things didn't go according to plan. And I'm always so grateful if things do go according to plan. But when they don't go according to plan, I mean, I've told you this story before about a women's group that got stuck in an airport once in Detroit. There was a Chabad convention many, many years ago, and it was just before Shabbos, and I don't know, it was, I don't exactly know, they had to get home for Shabbos. It was from Crown Heights. And there was a snowstorm many, many years ago. I'm talking about 50s, 60s. And they put a call through a payphone with quarters to the Rebbe's office, and the secretary answered the phone and said, could they please tell the Rebbe they need a bracha because they're stuck in an airport in Detroit, and it was snowing, the whole thing. So the secretary comes back and he says, the Rebbe wants to know, what does the word stuck mean? Which obviously the Rebbe knew what it meant. He spoke perfect English. But so he says, stuck, you know, the quarters are running out. So the secretary smiled and he said, the Rebbe knows what stuck means. The Rebbe asked me to tell you that a Jew is never stuck. There's a purpose. So what do? They got the worst stuck in the airports. What do? And at that time, the Rebbe was really strongly pushing a campaign for all women and girls to light Shabbat candles. And not everyone was doing that at the time. So they found a whole bunch of women. These group of women went searching women in the airport, told about Shabbat candles. And then many, many, many years ago, someone wrote a letter to one of the people in Crown Heights tracking someone down and said, you remember that time in the airport? I still light Shabbat candles because of you. So you're not stuck because you're there for a reason. So this is the concept of purpose. And that's why in the system, I'm just putting it in the context of the conference or whatever. Right? The context is that's why the Rebbe was very, when he sent someone somewhere, unless there was a good reason to leave, you're there. It's not a career. It's not a career path. That's your mission. And that's your purpose. But we need to apply this every single day, wherever we land up, wherever we happen to be. We're there. Not sometimes we even go somewhere for a reason we think is the reason. But it's not, there's a higher purpose. We need to always see what can we do to help someone, what can we do to bring more spirituality to the world, to inspire someone else. There's always a purpose because where you are is Ashgacha Pratit, which is a deeper level of purpose than just the basic Viktor Frankl one. It's a much deeper thing linked into that idea of Ashgacha Pratit. Okay, so that's just one thing that came through very strongly on that idea. The second thing is, the next one, the number two concept is always remembering that we have, people think, one of the biggest syndromes that prevent people from actualizing their purpose is because they think they're not capable. They think they need to be very talented or qualified to serve a purpose. Right? People are like, yeah, I'm just a little guy, I'm going about my thing, earning a living, paying the bills, and that's it. Right? But it's not like that. So I'll just tell you a beautiful story which I heard Rabbi Kotlarsky tell once on a video. It was printed in this book as well. A beautiful little story. So it was 1984. For those who don't know, Rabbi Moshe Kotlarsky was the chairman of the central body of Chabad educational arm. He passed away a few years, unfortunately, from cancer, but now his son took over. A very, very special person. But in 1984, he was very close with the Rebbe as well. In 1984, he got an urgent call from the Rebbe's right-hand man secretary, Rabbi Khadakov. And the Rebbe said that he wants him right away with another person. He wants Rabbi Kotlarsky. He didn't tell him why. He says, I want you right away to travel to an island of Curaçao. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Curaçao.
Sorry?
Curaçao.
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 Curaçao, okay. Curaçao. Oh, Curaçao, okay. Sorry, my geography again. Don, I don't have a very good geography teacher in school, just you should know. So you want to teach my ignorance. Okay, and he wasn't even told why. So he took another guy, his name was Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Rinsky, another yeshiva student. They took a flight to Curaçao. Absolutely no idea why they're going there. Took a taxi to the local synagogue. They found one. I mean, where do you go? Yeah, you go to shul, I guess. You got to find some Jews, right? And he found a man leaving the building. They approached him and they said, "Hi, we are Moshe Kotlarsky and Krinsky, whatever, and we were sent by the Lubavitcher Rebbe." So the guy looks at them, completely stunned, and he said, "Well, then you must have come for me." So he regains his composure, introduced himself as a guy called Chaim Groisman, a very secular Jew who had landed up in Curaçao somehow. And he had a child. That child attended a local public school. He told these two guys that what had happened was that in the local public school was like a Catholic school, but they were very, very respectful and the child was doing well there. He didn't do much Jewishly, but he knew he was Jewish. And like I had now, there was a new management of the school. And there's a whole problem because the school insists that the child participates on Sunday in the Catholic service. And the child doesn't want to. He doesn't want his child to. They're Jewish at the end of the day, and the child doesn't want to either. And now he'd been expelled, and it was a whole story with the confrontation with the headmaster. Anyway, it's a big mess, and this guy's very down. And he had come to the shul just to pray a little bit. He felt he should go daven in the shul and pray. And he walks out, and there are these two guys that were sent by the Rebbe. That's another part of the story I want to tell you. I want to tell you the end of the story. Bottom line is that a whole conversation, they invited the guy to New York with his son. And the son actually enrolled in a school in New York, a Jewish school, and got a Jewish education. And it was a very happy ending. And then, after their stay in Crown Heights, the father came to Crown Heights, left his son there. This Chaim Grossman wrote a 2-page letter to Rabbi Kotlarsky, gratitude, thanking him, and so on and so forth. And then he said like this, he said at the end of the letter, I want you to extend to the Rebbe my most sincere appreciation and other good feelings, but for lack of a good English, I do not know the words to use. Just tell the Rebbe that a small Jew from Curacao, say pronounce it, felt that the Rebbe touched my soul. Thank you for doing it. That was the end of the thing. So Rabbi Kotlarsky dutifully passed on the letter to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe wrote a whole response. And he said the following. I was pleased to receive your regards through our esteemed mutual friends. I must, wrote the Rebbe, however, take exception to your referencing, to referring to yourself as a small Jew from Curacao. There is surely no need to emphasize to you at length that every Jew, man or woman, has a nefesh al akis, a divine soul, which is like the godly soul. Tanya talks about it a lot, the Jewish soul, which is, then he quotes the Tanya, part of godliness above, as explained in the Tanya, beginning of chapter 2. Thus, there is no such thing as a small Jew. A Jew must never underestimate his or her tremendous potential. There's a whole postscript to the story, because a few years ago they had this thing called C-Teen, worldwide. It's a Chabad organization for all teenagers, like chapters in all different places in the world, and have this once a year Shabbaton where they have do like a huge Havdalah concert in, what's that place called where the ball drops? Times Square, right? And a few years ago, there was an amazing thing, and one of the guys that was there was the grandson of this Moshe Grossman. Because the son had come to school, he came with a very Jewish connection, and then his son got involved, and he was part of the C-Teen, and he came, and it was a very beautiful ending of the story. Okay. So that's just the idea of we all have a purpose. It's not just one person, not just people are great, not people that can teach. It doesn't have to be a big thing, but every person has the potential to do amazing things. But we have to remember the concept of we don't land in a situation, we make the situation. Because often the situation looks like an environment or an experience where we just don't feel that we can actually do anything. Or we don't think we can accomplish, it's too hard, it's too difficult. But we all can. We all can make a situation. If we take upon ourselves that teaching, that we don't land in a situation, we make the situation. And sometimes we can make amazing things just by small things. You know, there was a story of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov once taught his students. The Baal Shem Tov often would take his students for a walk and teach them things by going for a walk, right? So what happened was that he took them for a walk one day and they met what's called in the Alter Heim called the Wasserträger, which means the town water carrier. I've forgotten his name. He had a name, but I forgot what it was. And Baal Shem Tov stops and he's there with his students and he says to the Wasserträger, Nur Rabid, or whatever his name was, Was machst du? How are you? So he quetches and he says, you know, Rabbi, it's not easy to bring water every day. You got to climb mountains. My back is quetching. I'm a little bit older. There are some competitors who are younger. And he was quetching and quetching and quetching for like 10 minutes. So he says, no, I'm sorry to hear that. Have a wonderful day. Gives a bracha and they leave. A couple of days later, Baal Shem Tov says to his students, I want to take you for another walk. Take another walk, and who should they meet again? The same Wasserträger, the same water carrier. I don't know if it's a few days or 4 weeks, whatever. Baal Shem Tov looks at him and says, no, was machst du? He says, you know, Rebbe, I'm doing well, Baruch Hashem. No, it's not easy, but you know, I can still carry the water. I can still climb the mountain. Baruch Hashem, people still take me, they still use me, I make a few pennies, I can pay my bills. You know, all things considered, Gott sei Dank, as I say. Hashem says, thank you very much, have a good day. He takes it and he sees the same thing, like it's exactly the same circumstance. It's just a matter of perspective. How he looked at it. First day he looked at it, and we daven, you know, something we need Hashem to help us with sometimes. He said that part of the, because it was actually in response to a question that they asked him, because it says in the Talmud that on Rosh Hashanah, Hashem decides everything that's going to happen during the year, right? But then there's another Gemara which says that a person is like judged every day. So they didn't understand. What does that mean? Like, how can you be judged every day if it's all decided already in Rosh Hashanah, right? So there's many, many answers. It's a famous question and many, many answers, but because the bottom line is that prayer helps every day and you can change things even though. Okay, but he gave this perspective. He sees Hashem decides what you're going to have during the year. Every day your test is, and if you daven, Hashem will help you, but you have to want to do it. It's your choice then. Hashem will help you look at it properly. Make the situation with what you have. So what's going to happen? Saying I did this before, is the way you're going to respond to it, that's a daily thing. It can be exactly the same situation as yesterday. But yesterday you made something of it, and today you're kvetching. But or the other way around. But that's the daily struggle.
Okay. That's the give start to the plan if you want to
need it. Sorry?
That's the give start to the plan if you want to need it to come
here. Right, the morning blessing, correct. Now I want to just share with you one final point and then tell you an amazing story. One of the things that we suffer from also is that when we try to do good things, is how to define the word success. Because often we do things in life, we intend to do good things, and we think we failed. But we need to understand that our job is to try to live with purpose, and we never know and can never estimate the impact. So a couple of things I want to share with you on that note, right? I'm saying it in context of what this rabbi said, that, you know, you change the life of one Jew, you change the life, you do one thing, you do one mitzvah, you help one person, now you help people after the hurricane, whatever the case is, it doesn't look like monumental things, but you never know what it is. So there was a story in the early years of the Rebbe's leadership, there was a system, I was part of the system also, that America has two months of summer camp, of summer I'm saying, right? And so sometimes we would stay in yeshiva part of the time, but otherwise there was stuff to do, so some bochurim, some students would go to camp, and others would go what's called merkaz shlichut. Merkaz shlichut was that you go to remote towns where there aren't any rabbis or aren't any emissaries, and you go around, you find Jews, and you inspire them, right? I landed up once in Toledo, Ohio. Me and a guy, I remember we spent 2 weeks, we contacted, there was a local rabbi there, we asked him if we can meet, anyway, we tried to give people mezuzahs and tefillin and Jewish books and so on. Okay. We helped him out in shul a little bit, and then we laid the groundwork a little bit, because after that a Chabad rabbi came there a few years later. But it was like a very small town. So there was a story in the early years where two bachrim went, and it was a disaster. They went from house to house, no one wanted to talk to them, couldn't find anyone. They were there for a couple of weeks, and returned back, and nothing. And after a while, they were very upset about it. And they wrote a letter to the Rebbe. And said, we just feel very, like we let you down almost. Like, you know, you send all these guys out. And we didn't have any impact. And we weren't successful at all. So later on, the Rebbe spoke about this in public. And it's actually printed. This talk. And the Rebbe said, what they didn't know is that the Rebbe received a letter from someone in that town. It was standing on a balcony. It was a town with no Yiddishkeit, no Judaism, right? And they were standing on a balcony. And they saw these two students walking by. They were Holocaust survivors. And before the war, they had come to America, probably intentionally moving to a place where there wasn't anything Jewish. And they saw these two boys, and it ignited a memory. And it ignited a whole spark. And they ended up really reliving a bit of their past and Judaism, and they started to get more involved. And they wrote the Rebbe a letter to thank him for sending the boys. And these guys had no idea. The Rebbe said, it's not your business. You have to do what you need to do. And you leave the impact to God. You never know what the impact will be. Right? And the impact doesn't have to be big. It can be a tiny thing. Because first of all, we know that the Talmud tells us that why was a human being created alone? Which means when God created the world, he created all the animals in twos and pairs. When it came to Adam and Eve, he created them one after another, so that Adam was Nivra Yechidi. The person was created completely, just a single human being. Which God has said himself wasn't good because relationships are very key, and therefore he created Eve, and there was a relationship, right? But he could have created both of them together to begin with. But he didn't. Why? It says the Talmud, because they teach us that every individual human being is an Olam Malay. It's a full world. So it's not about doing amazing things. It's about sometimes when you find yourself somewhere, think to yourself, what can I do something? A small thing. We learn this from Hanukkah. I've shared this with you before. We learn this from Hanukkah. Hanukkah we go, we grow, of course. But an interesting thing, what we do is we light the candles in a Hanukkiah. And the first night we light one candle, but the rest of the night is empty. It looks a bit lonely, that one candle on the first night, right? What's the idea? There's a very big lesson. The lesson is that we can't stay where we are. We always have to grow. But we also don't have to do everything at once. We have to start one candle at a time. One person at a time. One mitzvah at a time. One thing at a time. Because that's how we live with purpose. One step at a time. Knowing that there's a bigger menorah. There's place to grow. But and tomorrow we'll do an extra candle. Another candle. But for now, one candle is also good. So I want to share with you an amazing story. This is a story from a rabbi called Rabbi Brisky. Whenever I've heard him tell the story twice. He once told it at a kinnus when I was there, a long time ago. And I heard it on my video. Whenever he tells a story, he prefaces the story by saying, I'm going to tell you this story, you might not believe me. Because it's the craziest story. But I know him, he doesn't make stuff up. Anyway, this is Rabbi Brisky. He lives in Agoura Hills. Agoura Hills is California somewhere. And he built a very successful Chabad institution there, bringing people close to Judaism. One of his great areas of emphasis, he has a friend of mine works for him also, and I've talked to him about it a lot, because when we started Bina, I was actually very interested in it, because he does a lot of adult education and teaching. Education is a big thing in his. Okay. So he says that he has a thing every Rosh Hashanah. It's a bit of a long story. I want to share with you, because it's a beautiful story. He says that every Rosh Hashanah, what they do is they rent like a very big hotel to accommodate the huge crowd of people that are coming to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And he brings out a bunch of bocharim from Crown Heights, because it's in America, it's easy to do, to help him out, to go blow shofar for Jews, to help him out sing in shul, and the whole thing, right? Okay. And then he rents a house for them, and he puts his bocharim in a house. So one Rosh Hashanah, after Rosh Hashanah, there was Shabbat after Rosh Hashanah, he stops in to visit his bocharim to see how they're doing, if they have enough food, if they have, you know. And he sees, what happened was, one of the bachrim, before Rabbi Brisky came to visit them, one of the bachrim sees just across the house, there's another house in Agoura Hills, and he sees this guy, the bachrim, sees a big moving truck. It says, young Jewish guy's moving truck or something. Oh, very good. So he goes across, meets a bunch of Israelis, and they've just pulled up to unload a truck, because there was a new guy moving into that house. So the young bachrim says to this guy, you're Jewish, obviously, right? Yeah, he says, we're all Jewish. He says, no, you want to come eat some chavin, some Shabbos meals? These guys are supposed to be in the middle of a job. But Israeli guys, he says, why not? Yeah. So they come across, they're sitting there, they get a bit of l'chaim, they had extra food. And then Rabbi Brisky walks in to visit them, and he sees his bachrim with a bunch of Israelis, and they're having a fabring, and they're having a great time. In the middle of this whole thing, suddenly one of the guys says, look, I just pulled up to the house across the road. The guy that's moving in, and we're in the middle of this, and we're in the middle of drinking on the job, right? Okay. So one of the brachim says, "Leave it to me." It was Rabbi Brisky's nephew, actually, young guy. He says, "Stay here. I'll go deal with it." He goes across to the guy, says, "Welcome to Agoura Hills." The guy looks at him. Oh, that's nice. Thank you. By any chance, are you Jewish? The guy says, "Yes, absolutely. In fact, not only I'm Jewish, but I sing in the choir in the Reform Temple." He says, great, so why don't you come join us? Why don't you come join us and have a l'chaim? He says, okay. So he comes in the house. He's introduced to his movers, who are busy having a feast. And they sit down, they start singing songs. This guy knows the songs, he's a choir master. He knows a lot of Jewish songs. And these guys are having a l'chaim, and they're singing songs till Motzei Shabbat, till the end of Shabbat. End of Shabbat, they make Avdallah, they finish Shabbat. The Israeli guys go across to finish the job. And the guy moves in across this house. Okay. Next day, Rabbi Brisky finds a note slipped under his door. And he says, and it says, this guy's name was Jack. He leaves his phone number. One line. He says, I want you to know that God works through you. Jack, phone number. Brisky's thinking to himself, well, what is that all about? Anyway, he called him up. He says, do you mind explaining? Wonderful, but you mind explaining what it means? So he says, Rabbi, I don't know if you're one of these rabbis that believe in God, but if you are, I want to tell you the following. He says, when I got into my car to drive to Agoura Hills, I wasn't sure if I'm doing the right thing, and I said to God, if I'm doing the right thing, send me a sign when I arrive. The moment I pulled in, some guy comes out, he says, welcome to Agoura Hills, are you Jewish? And if I speak to a Shabbos meal. Says, God works through you. Okay, good. So, Rabbi Brisky was all excited, because another few days was Yom Kippur. And he had a great sermon for Yom Kippur, right? He tells the story. So he gets up, he tells the story in shul. Suddenly, the back bench of the hotel, a whole bunch of guys get up and start cheering. He looks, and it's the Israeli movers, because they had decided to come to shul for Yom Kippur. They were part of the story. He heard the rabbi telling the story. They were so excited, they started to cheer. Okay. So this guy, this Jack, he started to come to some Torah classes that Rabbi Brisky was giving. And one evening, he was there at a... This Jack, he was there at a... This story is crazy. You'll see in a second. He's there at a series he was giving on faith. What was the name of the thing? It was on faith and suffering. Jack sits in this class, sitting through the whole class. And when the class finished, he walks over to Rabbi Brisky. He just hugs him and starts to cry. Cry uncontrollably. The rabbi says to him, Jack, do you want to come to my office or the chat? He says, yes, I do. So Jack walks into Rabbi Brisky's office and he says to him, I've never told you the first part of the story, and I think I need to tell it to you. What's the first part of the story? He says, a year earlier, or 2 years earlier, him and his wife tragically had 3 children, and tragically 2 children died in a car accident. It was a terrible time in his life. He said the grief just consumed him and swallowed him. I lost my job. I went into a deep depression. I couldn't work. I lost everything. And eventually I lost my marriage, and I went into a very big depression. And then he says, one day I decided that it was time to say goodbye. I'm going to take my life. But before I did, I wanted to take my daughter out to a movie to say goodbye to her. So he calls his ex, picks up his daughter, and they chose a shopping center called the Mountain Valley Shopping Center. It's called in a place called Simi Valley in California, near Guru Hills, whatever. And I had a movie theater. He says, as I approached, I heard music, Jewish music. And then I saw a menorah. It was Hanukkah, obviously, right? And as I came and I was about to go into the movie theater, someone grabbed my hand and started dancing with me. I don't know, I started dancing round, round, round the menorah. And he says, as I was dancing around the menorah, I felt that God was talking to me, saying, there's warmth, there's hope, we still need you, stick around, all that kind of stuff. And he says, as he was dancing around the menorah, he went to the movie afterwards, but as he was dancing, he decided he's not taking his life. He's going to actually get his life back together. And he says, I didn't say goodbye to my daughter that night. I decided to fight for my life. I returned to therapy, he says. I got my job back eventually. I started a bit of a real estate agent. And then I just had this feeling that I need to move out of my neighborhood. I need a fresh, clean start. Which is why I called up a real estate agent and I said, find me a house. I don't care where it is, but just somewhere out of this neighborhood. And the real estate agent found me this house in Agoura Hills. Which is why when I got into the car, I said to God, if I'm doing the right thing, send me a sign when I get to Agoura Hills. And that's what happened. Okay. He's crying. He's finishing the story. And then Rabbi Brisky looks at him like in shock. Rabbi Brisky gets up, pulls out one of his photo albums of his Hanukkah menorah as he does every day. And he finds the page where he is dancing with Jack. And then he tells Jack the story. Listen to this. This is a point where I want to tell you the story. Like, it was him. It was Rabbi Brisky. It was Jack. It was a small crowd there. Very small crowd. You'll see why in a second. And then he told his side of the story. And he said the following. He says, every year in his Chabad center, he has this thing that he wants to take a menorah to a different area every year. He's got a few areas that are around where he is. And every year he likes to go to a different area. Okay. One year that decided, they're going to this place called Simi Valley, whatever, right? Okay, Rabruski's like a really like, just let's get it done. Like, no, there's no process and strategy, just let's do, right? So he calls 411, you know 411? I mean, this before, like 5-1 steps. 411 is like, you could call in New York to find the addresses of things. I mean, in America, you call the directory on the phone. So he calls 411 and he says, can you give me the shopping center in Simi Valley? He says, which shopping center? He says, a shopping center. So the operator looks it up and he gives him this one. Okay. So he starts making a flyer, where he's advertising, and then a couple of days later he realizes, he forgot to call the shopping center to ask permission. You can't just put a menorah in front of a shopping center. So he calls Mountain Valley Shopping Center. Someone answers the phone. He says, I'm the Rabbi Chabad. We put a menorah every year. Celebration. It's Hanukkah. Can I put one? So the guy says, you sure you want to put a menorah here? Like, I don't mind, but you sure? He said, yeah, put a menorah. Hanukkah. The guy says again, are you sure that you actually want to come here? He says, yeah, of course, I just told you, I'm sure. Okay, no problem, you have permission, it's fine. So, they balloons, clowns, music, orchestra, everything's arranged, flyers all over the place. Supposed to be, he thinks it's a very busy shopping center. He arrives there, and he realizes that this shopping center is going out of business. It's about to be sold. All the shops are closed. There's no one there. The only thing that's open is the movie theater. That's still there for another little few weeks. Oh, well, you know, he's there already, so what should you do? He says, well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go and put it at the entrance where you go into the movie center. We're going to just, him and a couple of other rabbis, whatever, and we're just going to do it. Hopefully, some of the movie theater will get some, whatever. And then, you know, someone came along, a couple of people danced. Rabbi Risky says, I went home that night thinking, this is one of the worst things I've ever done. What a flop. What a flop. Total disaster. You know, we all have mistakes, right? You know, we all have things we do sometimes. It doesn't work out. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Complete flop. And I realize, it says, I saved a life that night. I brought back a Jew to life and to Judaism. And he ends the story by saying, there's no ordinary day in God's world. Every day you do something. So that's the lesson. The lesson is, we have to live with purpose and one person at a time, and we never know the impact that we can have. We never know. Sometimes we'll find out, sometimes we won't find out. It doesn't matter. We don't have to find out. That's not our job. Our job is to do and to shed light. Have a wonderful week. We'll do one more next week, please, guys.